Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told with professional and volunteer rescuers, lawmen, and sailors working on oceans worldwide.
Regardless the flag their vessels fly or the uniform they wear, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast and our first full episode of our brand new Distant Shore series that's going to bring you interviews with guests who are working waters well beyond the U.S. coastline. We are so stoked to get access to these guys through our partnership with the Association for Rescue at Sea, and really stoked to get the conversation started with them and find out their lessons learned and hear some sea stories from waters throughout the world. To find this series after this inaugural episode that we're going to post everywhere, just search Distant Shores on your favorite podcast platform. When you find it, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, share, and give those 5-star reviews so we can keep the momentum up and bring you more guests and more episodes going forward. First guest, so stoked to have him on, stoked that we have a shared experience, and I'm sure it's going to be a great conversation. Who we've got on the line today, Mr. Francois Michaud, born in Quebec City, Canada. 2002, he joined the Canadian Coast Guard and went to work a decade as ship's crew and as a rescue specialist at lifeboat stations along the British Columbia coast. He holds a 150-ton master license and now works for Royal Canadian Mounted Marine SAR, which is the division of the Canadian Coast Guard Auxiliary, and is responsible for search and rescue along the nation's western coast. He's currently the chief instructor of the agency's training facility on the west coast of Vancouver Island, working to design and deliver training curriculum to over 1,000 volunteers at 35 active stations. What a job. Francois, welcome to the show. I'm going to go ahead and kick it off and ask you, what is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
There's a lot of adventures and great stories I could share. Some I probably shouldn't.
That's all sea stories.
Yeah, the main thing for me, guys, is especially as it relates to my current position as an instructor, I have a responsibility, and I think that the biggest responsibility is to keep people safe from the training that you provide and the experience that you bring to the table. And I don't know of anybody that can say that are very good at anything if they haven't learned from their mistakes. And, it's usually when things go sideways that you learn something, especially when you get to come back and talk about it. Not all of us have the same sort of luxury to be able to say that. I was lucky enough that I got some close calls from bad decisions, poor judgment on my part, due to the events and the factors that led to the events. But I usually try to use those events in my training and talk about them and talk about how I learned from the decision making that went into putting myself and my peers at risk during those events. So there's a lot of them. There's a lot of crazy stories. I've never been a guy that's much about the Hollywood style of search and rescue hero story, you know. And just a regular guy that joined Canadian Coast Guard a number of years ago and received the appropriate training to be able to do the job and to do it as safely as I possibly could do it. And you know, I'm 45 years old. I'm still around and been in many situations. So I guess the decisions that I've made were, for the most part, good enough to so that I'm still around the top.
Keep you around.
Yeah. Yes, keep me around.
Right.
So essentially that's what I'm trying to do with the way I train people is I try to share most of the good and the bad so that it allows them to cut corners in terms of the time it takes to realize, proper procedure to remain safe. Because as you probably know yourself, when you're training volunteers, unfortunately, these individuals don't have the same amount of exposure to the amount of exposure that, let's say, a full-time paid individual that does the same line of work has. So the amount of seat time that you have is just simply not the same. You just don't benefit from the same level of exposure because you're a volunteer and you have limited amount of time to devote to that. Mm-hmm. And it's just the nature of the beast, and that's the way it is. So what do you do as an instructor? You try to use the amount of time and exposure that you've had and experience that comes with that, and you share that experience with them so that they learn from it and hopefully make better decisions should they be faced with a similar situation. One of the big things that makes part of our training is for people to understand weather and forecasting and how it relates to sea conditions and how things change drastically and very quickly, especially in most of the areas of operation of the British Columbian coast. It's a very, very rugged coastline. It's subjected to very large tides, very large currents that are associated with those large tidal increments between high and low tides.
What are they up there, Francois? What are the tidal differences?
Well, in the wintertime, during a new moon or, during king tides around January and in the upper portions, the upper latitudes of the BC coast, you can easily see close to 25-foot tides.
You got to have a dock like at the low tide mark almost just to right. Like a whole new dock. Man, that's wild. 25 feet.
Oh, let me tell you, when I was on ships in the Coast Guard, often as a quartermaster, I'd go to bed, we'd show up in a dock, at a dock, we'd moor the vessel, and the gangway would be pointing like 40 degrees down towards the jetty. And I'd wake up for my watch 12 hours later, and I'd be looking up, and I'd be looking at pilings with anemones dripping off of them and everything. Like you're like 15 feet underneath the dock. And then you got to move the gangway from different decks on the ship so that it's still feasible to safely load and offload the vessel or, have people leave and join the boat. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy. And as you can imagine, with that kind of tidal increment comes with very, very strong currents. And, the bottom contours of the coastline around here are all over the place. We have very narrow inlets. They're extremely deep, extremely shallow areas and waterways that meander through all sorts of hazards and bottom contours. And if you have a strong wind opposing a tide, you have two forces opposing each other and you have pretty steep waves, and that can happen very quickly. And for a lot of people that don't understand that and those phenomena or not spend any great length of time at sea where they can experience that and see it and predict it and understand what the dangers associated with that, it can turn an easygoing situation into a very challenging one very quick. Mm-hmm. So part of the decision making before we go is a full weather analysis. An understanding of tides, understanding how tides change with the lunar cycles throughout the month, and understanding the prevailing wind patterns in the wintertime, versus the summertime, and localized wind phenomena and current phenomena is very important.
Francois, is that where you start? Like, if you got a brand new person, volunteer, right, very motivated to get out there and do the mission, you've explained the mission to them, they understand it, or of the organization. Is that where you start, is weather?
No, weather comes along at various stages of the training curriculum, but currently the structure with the volunteers is when you join a station as a new crew, you got to go through certain sign-offs and familiarization items. You got to do a check ride. You got to have certain prerequisites like a VHF radio operator card, a basic marine first aid, a pleasure craft operator card. Some of the basics that allows you to be on a fast response craft. The average size of our vessels is about 28 feet. Mm-hmm. Usually powered by twin outboards, 200 horse each, or a full cabin jet propulsion vessel with Hamilton jet engines, two of them producing about, I think, don't quote me on that, but I think it's around 900 horse. Mm-hmm. Top speeds about 45 knots. And those vessels are about 35 feet and just shy of 5 gross tons displacement. So these vessels come with a lot of bells and whistles, like FLIR cameras. There's like 3 or 4 different VHF radios on board, direction finding equipment, advanced electronics to navigation, radar, electronic chart displays, heading sensors, and you name it. So when you have a brand new, person join that has limited experience on the water as far as being a boater, and you throw them in a boat that looks like the cockpit may look to them like the cockpit of an F-18, right, it takes some familiarization and training.
For sure.
So there's definitely a learning curve that needs to take place. Because we get our volunteers from all walks of life. Some of them have professional mariner background. Some of them don't. So it's all over the place. So you have to find a standard and draw a line in the sand that works for everybody.
Yep.
So we start with basic training, familiarization items, check rides, and sign-off items in terms of, learning about hypothermia, signs of hypothermia, self-rescue, man overboard recoveries, nav aids, basic chart work, passage planning, practical pilotage, continued first aid, navigation, radar and GPS theory and practicums. And at all the different levels, some of those topics come back, but just at a higher level as you move up through the ranks. So you go through new crew, crew, advanced crew, and eventually coxswain level, which is the most advanced, where you receive some leadership training, a little bit of bridge resource management, decision-making, risk analysis, and so on, understanding the policies and that are in place within the organization so that should something bad happens, you're covered. So there are certain level of activities that are authorized where some are not. So we want to make sure that our crews are operating within the scope, the scope of authorized activities. Okay. We have a standardized way of doing things, standardized communication, closed loop communication style. We provide advanced training with navigating for restricted visibility. The Pacific Northwest is subjected to very thick fog in the summertime from advection fog phenomena. And certain areas of our coastline are blanketed under thick fog for 4 months of the summer. I've been in conditions where you can't see the bow of your own vessel. So to head out in those conditions doing 20, 25 knots in a coastline that is basically peppered with hazards like reefs and shoals and kelp beds, rocks, and heavy traffic area, it's pretty serious business when you're sending civilians in those vessels or doing 40 knots. There's a huge sense of responsibility and leadership that must be passed on. And I think that's where some of the bad experiences that I've had in my professional career as a mariner come at play in my training. You know, I try to share that those experiences with them to really sink in a sense of how much, like how serious the business is to go out there. It's an inherent risk. You can only do certain things to mitigate the level of risk, but you're never going to completely eliminate the risk of stepping on a boat and going out there. So the importance of systems checks and seaworthiness of the vessel and system integrity, having a standardized means of communication among the crew, proper terminology, very basic seamanship and seamanship safety is very important to give those guys the fundamentals block, the fundamentals of seamanship, you know, and navigation and basically boating safety so that they can go, hopefully go out there, provide some assistance to a mariner in need and come back with positive outcomes and everybody back at the dock safe and with the sense that they've done something positive, they've given back to their community, gives you a sense of self-worth and feels good, you know?
For sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing.
I always think, you know, what you ever heard of the, you know, they call it like the flow. Do you know the flow? Do you guys ever talk about the flow up there?
Say that again.
It's called the flow. You ever heard of the flow? You know, guys that do extreme sports like, you know, wingsuiting or base jumping or something. The flow is like when you're in the zone. You know the zone, right? Like when you're dialed in and seconds turn into minutes, turn into hours, that kind of thing.
It's that's focus when everything connects and your situational awareness is heightened and you're in full positive control of every single thing that you're doing and you can foresee what's going on ahead and everything connects as it should. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's why guys stay in this line of work. I think on the water, you hit the flow more than probably anywhere else, it seems, especially when you're along a rugged coast in fog responding to somebody whose life's in jeopardy.
Yeah, the sure gets your adrenaline going. And there's nothing like heading out in an FRC in wide open ocean swell, like a big, you know, 4 meter swell, you know, I guess 12 feet in your system. You know, big giant rollers spread apart together with not much of a chop on top and just planing at 30, 35 knots, you know, on top of that and heading out. It is definitely, gets the adrenaline going and puts a smile on your face, but it's also if you're prepared,
it puts a smile on your face. If you're not, it might be a different reaction.
Yeah. I've always said this job takes a little bit of ADD. Like you have to have a little bit of that attention where like what's coming at me next. Cause that's what makes us good at this job is we're always kind of, what's coming at me next? And it keeps you excited and engaged the whole time you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It does. It really does. You know, there's situations where you find yourself I can speak for myself only, but I've found myself in situations at time where I was like, what am I doing here? And I wonder what the person with a normal job is thinking right now as they're stuck in bumper to bumper traffic downtown,
right.
You know?
Yeah, right. For sure. I love it. That's good.
It's great. It certainly makes you feel like you're alive when you come back. And I remember this call, we were in the seventh, we have vessels here that in the Coast Guard, we call 733s. When I was in the Coast Guard, there were 733s. It refers to the length of the vessel. They're made by, a company called Hurricane, and there's the Zodiac model, which you're probably familiar with.
Yep.
A Hurricane, Zodiac is the brand, and the Hurricane is the model. So Zodiac, Hurricane, 733 means 7.33 meters. They've been superseded now by the 753, so they're a little bit longer. It better accommodates a stretcher when we're doing medevacs. But that thing is relatively quite light and has quite a bit of horsepower on the stern. And it handles like a dirt bike on the ocean. It's fantastic.
That sounds awesome.
It turns on a dime, and it's pretty fun. You know, it's pretty exhilarating. We go through this course called the Rigid Hull Inflatable Operator Training that's delivered by fantastic instructors in the Coast Guard. It's out of Bamfield on the West Coast. And that's kind of your training it's basic boat handling training and seamanship for towing between small vessels, heavy weather handling. You know, where they teach you how to drive these boats and handle these vessels in huge seas, station keeping, understanding wave theory and how the ocean behaves depending on the bathymetry, the bottom contours, and so on. It's a very good training, and many agencies have to go through that school. And once you've gone through that school, then you can become the operator on the ship of the fast response craft. And then you learn, you know, with experience. But I remember one time I was on a ship, and our responsibility was to, on behalf of the Department of Fisheries and Ocean, we had to officially open a fishery opening for a gillnet and a purse seining opening for salmon at the mouth of the Nitnat. And the Nitnat Lake on Vancouver Island is basically an inner, it's not really a lake, it's connected to the ocean, but via an extremely narrow opening. It's about a cable wide, like 600 feet wide maybe. And it's quite a long, large body of water, and it's salt water because it comes from the ocean. And when you have an ebb tide, all that water ebbs back to the ocean via this tiny narrow opening that's quite shallow. Now, if you put a westerly wind against that, you can imagine the conditions at the mouth of where all that water exits into the ocean, and it turns into, you know, pretty challenging conditions real quick. The salmon opening that year was in, I believe, in November, and it's when we get a lot of our storms in the latitudes where we live here on the West Coast. And it's not unusual at that time of the year to get storm force, gusting hurricane force winds. And I remember that morning we opened up the fishery, and which allowed the fishermen to officially start, you know, launching their nets, and they're all jockeying for position, for the best, you know, position for success. These guys are people that have, with their licenses, maybe 3 or 4 days to do their entire year worth of income from that fishery opening alone. Wow, so you can just imagine the competition and the tension on the water.
Yeah.
Now, so when these guys are taking turns and they're basically setting up and launching their nets, you're talking about hundreds of boats, you know, trying to line up and trying to find some form of order in which they're going to, you know, sweep through the opening and, you know, with their nets. Our job was to stage the ship slightly offshore from that after we opened the fishery and launched the 733, which I was at the helm, and with the mate from the ship, and approach each and every fishing vessel and record the license number from the side of the hull. And without being too intrusive, we had to basically get them to step outside for a brief moment and provide information about what was their estimated bycatch in the nets, what was their estimated catch, confirm their license number, and so on. Essentially, you're just pissing them off.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you put that there. Yeah, I knew that was coming. Yeah.
You know, I must say, though, that I had the pleasure of having an extra $10 as danger pay because I had to wear a flak jacket for that duty.
That's awesome.
So the first time I did it, and the bosun handed me a flak jacket, which a bulletproof jacket, like a Kevlar vest. I was like, why do I have to wear this? It's like, well, you never know with these guys.
Trust me, right? Like, just trust me, put it on. That's good.
Trust me, put it on. Besides, you're going to want the $10 increase.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of funny, but yeah, so you're going out there with your bulletproof jacket, and you're taking the officer to each and every vessel, and the challenge with that is to not run over the nets. They're mostly submersed, and the only way that you can determine where the nets are is from a little flag that's on a float that, you know, is at the surface of the ocean.
Right.
Well, the weather flared up pretty quick that morning, and it got ugly really, really quick. It got to a point where you're losing the boats in the trough. Know what I mean?
Right.
Perspective from your line of sight. And as you're going from boat to boat with the wind and the drift from the net, I mean, if you're going to run over one of those nets and ruin it, you guarantee they're going to shoot at you.
It's just coming.
That's their livelihood, and I don't blame them.
Right.
But, I mean, joking aside, it's extremely stressful. I mean, you're white knuckled on the helm, and you're like, your only focus, you got to maintain situational awareness of where the swell is coming from, where the chop is coming from, where the vessels are located, where their nets are, where's the extreme most sort of end, the distal end of the net is. And sometimes it's very close to another net from another vessel. And you're zigzagging your way through there, and you're trying to station keep while the mate is gathering information and writing this down in the logbook, and you're talking on the radios, and you're multitasking, and it's pretty stressful. It got to a point where the seas build up to 4 meters, 12 to 15 feet, with maybe 2 feet of chop on top of it. The visibility got reduced drastically from sea spray. Wind picked up to 35, 40 knots, gale force. And the fog rolled in, and it started to rain sideways.
Dude, that's setting it up for a sea story right there.
Just add some lightning and thunder in there, and we're all set.
Yeah, you're good.
It had to get interesting. I guess we were getting kind of bored.
Right.
But the thing is that people started to get gravely injured within the fishing fleet. So we had deckhands from the fishing boat receiving the block, on deck. Like, we had head injuries. Severe leg injuries to a point where we eventually had to shut down the fishery and tell them we were shutting it down for the day because of weather conditions.
Right.
It's not like, oh, okay, everybody leaves their car and walks home. I mean, they got to pick up their gear. The seas are getting worse, and then they got to go back to an anchorage that is in a sheltered inlet, not very far from that area. As the medical calls started to come in, our duty now was no longer to act as some sort of enforcing agency or an oversight agency. Now we were back in our role as Coast Guard and search and rescue. The lifeboat station that resides just north of that area got tasked. They were about maybe 45 nautical miles north. It was just at the edge of their area of operation, and they had to come in with their rescue specialist to medevac the individuals that were armed off the fishing boats. The problem with that is that the lifeboats, they came in with the 47 motor mm-hmm. lifeboat, the 47 footer. They're the same as what you guys have in the U.S. Coast Guard, just a different paint job on it.
Right.
And it wasn't very conducive for those specific vessels to come alongside seiners and gillnetters because of the sea conditions. So what they did is that they deployed their rescue specialists with the full paramedic kit and the oxygen bottles and so on and the stretchers on board smaller vessels like 733s. And then they would go and pace alongside the fishing vessels that were jogging into the seas, just maintaining like 5-6 knots against the seas so that you can safely come alongside and deploy people from ship to ship.
Right.
And recover injured patients so that you can deploy them on the lifeboat. And then the lifeboat would take them 45 miles north to the helipad where they would get medevaced by helicopter, like the more severe cases.
Dude, what a process, huh?
Yeah, that's wow.
That's the only thing you can do. Because
yeah, for sure.
The coastline where Nitnat Lake is located on the west coast of Vancouver Island, it's just sheer cliffs and like deep water right up to the shore.
Yeah, nowhere else
you
to
can't
go.
Land a helicopter there.
Yeah.
And because of the winds and the condition, the helicopter couldn't quite medevac off the actual platforms. There's all sorts of rigging in the way. The tagline or the basket, it wouldn't have worked.
Sure.
Okay. And most of the injuries, although quite severe, weren't necessarily life or death either.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So there was time to do an assessment and preserve and just kind of mitigate the injuries until they were deployed to a higher level of care via helicopter straight to the hospital.
So one question for you, Francois, as I hear you talking about you guys using your 47-foot motor lifeboat. So you said you have a paramedic on board with like full oxygen and everything. Is that kind of standard when they take that 47 out? Is that somebody who's always, do they always have a paramedic?
Okay.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
So let's just make sure for terms of not getting myself in trouble here to differentiate between terminology, okay?
Okay.
So every lifeboat station in the Canadian Coast Guard, at least on the Pacific Coast, and when I was part of that crew, comprises of four crew members. One is the officer in charge, so the coxswain. That's obviously in charge of the station and so on. There's a chief engineer and two rescue specialists / deckhands.
Okay.
So when I was at the lifeboat stations, for instance, I was a rescue specialist because I had the riot training certificate, the rigid hull inflatable operator training.
Okay.
And I also had what's called the Medic A training from Coast Guard, which is essentially the equivalent of EHS, I think, level one, which is you can ride along in ambulances, and you're I think you're just below a paramedic. Don't quote me on that. I mean, it's been a number of years ago since I was an official rescue specialist.
Sure, but it's still a fairly high level of training in that case.
You're essentially allowed to deliver Antinox and assist with injections.
Okay.
Yeah. So pretty high level on the U.S. side, as far as, you know, when you get into,
it's like EMT level at that point.
EMTI, probably EMTI, I would call it.
It is.
The cool thing though is that it sounds like it was provided by the Canadian Coast Guard itself, right? This was a Canadian Coast Guard medical course you went to.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's delivered by Coast Guard training officers and. It is also in conjunction with the Canadian Red Cross, I believe.
Okay.
Has their paws in there, I think.
Is it pretty maritime specific when you went through it?
Say again?
Was it pretty maritime specific when you went through it? Like, were they?
It's like a Marine Advanced First Aid and then some.
Very cool.
Okay. Yeah. So the Canadian Red Cross offers a course called Marine Advanced First Aid. And it is mandated by the Transport Canada, which if you have a commercial marine ticket, like for instance, I detain a 150-ton Masters.
Right.
In order for me to be able to write or to sit through an oral exam to get my 150-ton, as a prerequisite, I must have a Transport Canada Marine Advanced First Aid, which is offered by the Canadian Red Cross, whom offers various different first aid training. But the Marine Advance is a prerequisite in many of the marine trade. You know, if you want to be a deckhand on a ship or ship's crew for the Coast Guard, or if you can be a rescue specialist at a lifeboat station without the Medicaid training of Coast Guard, if you have the Marine Advance first aid.
Okay.
And then eventually, if you're going to stick around, they're going to put you through the actual Coast Guard Medicaid training.
Yeah, gotcha. Very good.
So at the time, I wasn't a rescue specialist yet. I was ship's crew.
Okay.
And I came off of an offshore ship that was there to patrol for fisheries on fisheries' behalf.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Fisheries and Ocean and the Canadian Coast Guard are a non-military agency of Canada, and whose military is the Canadian Navy. Right. So Canadian Coast Guard in Canada is non-armed and is not an agency that is able to enforce the law. They're there to protect the safety of mariners, protect the the marine ways for shipping, for marine shipping, and protect the environment, the marine environment. So,
but thankfully they get flak jackets issued just in case they got to go out and record hole numbers, right?
Right.
We can't shoot at you, but you can shoot at us. We got flak jackets.
Hey, but you're getting $10 extra.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But essentially with that call, what ended up happening is a number of severe medevac had to take place. And my role, since I was already on the water in a 733 from a ship, was to provide assistance to the lifeboat that was on scene and be able to go and collect gear from the lifeboat and deploy it and deliver it to the fishing boats. So coming alongside, pacing alongside, station keeping in 15-foot seas, restricted visibility, with gear swinging all over the fishing boat, and making sure that my crew was safe during the approach, and making sure I maintained contact while the rescue specialist was boarding the vessel and moving equipment back and forth.
Right.
So new oxygen bottles or Entonox, whatever the case was. I ended up in the water in the 733 for about 9 hours straight because the ship, the mothership that I came from, was a small 90-foot flat bottom buoy tender that was not designed to be offshore in those conditions.
Sounds miserable.
Yeah, so the captain had to jog into the ocean, stemming weather, mm-hmm. and just jog at slow speed, waiting for the storm to calm down. Because I remember my captain's words on the VHF, I can't turn around and meet you in this place called Port Renfrew, which is a safe haven. It's an inlet that's sheltered from the wind, and mm-hmm. that's where we would anchor overnight. And that's where the fleet of fishing vessel would anchor overnight when they weren't fishing. So it's an inlet. It's a dead end body of water that indents the west coast of Vancouver Island. There's a small town at the end called Port Renfrew. And that's where we anchored, between the days. He could not turn around to go back there and seek shelter and safely bring me back on board the ship. That's how rough it was.
Yeah.
So I just had to tough it out with whoever I had on the boat, mm-hmm. And help the rescue specialist and its team the best we could with their medevacs until such a time where we were able to proceed back to Port Renfrew ahead of the ship because they still couldn't turn around. And then we moored the 733 and went to there was a local pub there where we could seek shelter because we were soaked to the bones.
I like where you sought shelter, by the way.
Local pub. Where
if you're going to seek shelter anywhere, that's a good spot.
That's what you're
saying. There's nothing else there. So yeah. you go to the Lighthouse Pub because that's the only pub on the coast that's called the Lighthouse, you know?
That's good.
I gotcha.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, it was a long day, and it was it was exhilarating at the end. I was younger and I had the shape to deal with it. I don't know if I would have as much fun today as I did back then doing that. I learned a lot. It was extremely stressful to maneuver that vessel around the nets without running him over and paying attention to what's going on and being able to foresee ahead where the fishing vessel is going to end up and keeping in mind and a lookout for waves coming astern and turning around to face the wave last minute and then come back the other way and kind of jog your way through. It got to a point when I was delivering gear between the boats that, I mean, we couldn't see the horizon. It was, the visibility was reduced drastically from seafoam. And the swells were high enough that where you were in the trough, you couldn't see anything. You were looking at a kind of a hill of water that you would climb. I didn't have the radar in front of me. I didn't have the training to use the radar back in those days. I do now. That is what I teach, is radar for FRC. I do blind navigation training and so on. And I think that all those experiences, and that's just one of them, has forged me as an instructor into what I will choose to deliver for training, what to me is a priority as a boat operator that is asked to deliver that kind of service in those kinds of conditions and prepare for the worst and hope for the best. There was a time where I was an assistant instructor when I was still in the Coast Guard, and I decided to volunteer as an assistant instructor for the courses that were being delivered to the Coast Guard Auxiliary. And we were sent out for a final evaluation on a night run, where the weather conditions changed drastically. And in front of downtown Victoria, which is located at the southernmost tip of Vancouver Island, there are three main bodies of water that meet in one common area. There's Puget Sound by Seattle in the States that comes north and dumps back into the Pacific, and it has to make its way through a number of Gulf islands. There's Harrow Strait on our side of the border that is facing Vancouver City, that's called Georgia Strait and Harrow Strait, and that has to ebb back to the ocean via another body of water that's called Juan de Fuca. So you got Vancouver Island that's like a wedge into the continent. You got Seattle just below us, the Olympic chain of mountain, the Olympic Peninsula of the Washington State, and then open Pacific Ocean. And the entire Pacific has to flood and ebb through this narrow 10 nautical mile wide body of water called Juan de Fuca Strait, and wraps around the south tip of Vancouver Island, where it meets with Puget Sound and Harrow Strait. And it's a bunch of Gulf islands, beautiful body of water. It's amazing. It's very popular for yachting, and that keeps us busy, of course.
Yeah, that's what I heard. When you say three bodies of water converge, it basically gets squirrely. It can get, right. you can have bad days. Yeah.
I've been anywhere between Seattle and Alaska, both via the inside and outside passage many times during my time on board buoy tenders. Our job is to basically service and maintain every single piece of navigational aid equipment up and down the BC coast, including all the light stations are still manned. Mm-hmm. So the lighthouses that still have people in them, we're there to go. We go pick up their trash, their recycling, bring supplies and whatnot. It's all done the old school way with work boats and bonnets of equipment with cranes that are operated with diesel generators and so on. And
we're going to lose Bill. Bill's going to defect north is what's going to happen. I see it coming. Yeah, he loves it. Are you guys hiring?
That was some of the best times I've had in the Coast Guard was on board buoy tenders. Yeah. Hard work. But you get to see every single bit of the coastline.
For sure.
It's just absolutely fantastic. We train with the U.S. Coast Guard. We do in Alaska, we do a buoy tender roundup. It's essentially a big piss up between us and the U.S. Or our U.S. comrades, where we have Mariners games and contests and we do co-training, of course. It's serious, too. I mean, we do exchange training and practices. But at night, we all get together and exchange. And it's quite a wonderful experience. It's a brotherhood, really.
You seek shelter in the pub, right?
Yeah, it's called the Lighthouse.
Back at it.
The thing is, you know, when I was on what I was talking about, I tend to take curveballs, and everybody that knows me knows that. But trying to stay focused on what I was saying essentially was the fact that when I was an assistant instructor for the Coast Guard Auxiliary, I was asked to take a group of students for their on-the-water portion evaluation, which we still do. We have an actual FRC that is modeled after the standardized vessels that we use. And there's a final evaluation where there's a mock-up of a SAR call, and they have to go tow this other vessel, and there's decision-making that's being evaluated and so on. And the navigational portion of getting the vessel there and back. At a higher level of training, we have curtains around the nav seat, so the navigator can't see anything and has to nav the vessel at effective speeds by GPS and radar alone. I think I've shared with you some videos of that from my Facebook Coxswain Leadership page.
Yeah, for sure. I love it. I think what a cool way to train and build. I think you build a lot of confidence in the gear, and then you build a lot of confidence in the students, you know, just knowing how to use it.
I don't think there's a better way to validate whether they picked up what you were trying to put down, you know?
For sure, yeah. I don't think they can fake that one, right?
They either are going to get from point A to B and back, or they're going to get,
Who knows what's going to, or something else is going to happen. Yeah.
They're going to get wet, or they're going to get really dry, one of the two.
Yeah. But so that night, the weather changed drastically, and we had southeasterly 45 knots against the full flood tide, which opposes each other in a narrow channel that we had to proceed through between an island and the mainland portion of the island. In that specific area, it makes a 45 degree or almost 90 degree turn, and it's about, it's 1200 feet wide, and halfway through there's shoaling that comes up to about 3 feet deep at low tide at datum. So you have,
of course, all there is.
Yeah, because why not, right? Mother Nature had to throw you one. Yeah.
Okay. You have all this massive body of water that is trying to ebb. That's trying to flood through this channel. And it's being met at the top end where it shallows all of a sudden to 3 feet at low tide. It is being met with 45 knots of wind. It creates a bar. And that bar has 15 to 18 foot stand-up waves. It's like being in a river.
Yeah.
And they're all about 6 feet apart and staggered like this. And they just break on top of each other because of the wind against the current. It's like a stand-up wave.
We call that the East Coast in the United States.
Right.
Yeah. The Atlantic is pretty notorious.
Yep.
I used to vacate on the East Coast. I'm from Quebec, so I spent a lot of time in PEI and Maine.
Yep.
And we used to go to Old Orchard and Cape Ann and Boston and, Massachusetts. And yep. So I'm familiar with the area there, too. And I surfed in Europe on a surf trip in the Bay of Biscay of the Atlantic, and it's nice. Pretty nasty. Yeah. It's crazy. But when we got there, it was so nasty, and it was at nighttime. The evaluation has to take place at night to create an extra challenge. This is back in the previous courses that we had. And what ended up happening is it was so bad. We found ourselves in a situation where the boat was pointing straight up at the sky. The boat is 27 feet long, but there's still at least 10 feet of slope of the face of the wave ahead of you, with breaking white foam water coming over, swamping the entire cabin. I'm not sure if we're going to come back. There's no turning
this
around.
This was an auxiliary check ride too, right? You said this was for...
It was.
Yeah, I mean, what a situation, man, to put the volunteers in, right?
Right.
Just to find out if they're going to be cut for the job is you throw them in hot water and see if they can swim,
oh,
right?
There you go, man. That was that's some hot water right there. Yeah.
You know, I should probably mention that since that night, standard operating procedures and risk analysis have been put into place so we can't do that anymore.
Well, sure. Okay? You learn from it. You know, you learn from it and you got better. Yeah. I mean, that's like you said earlier.
I certainly did. That was okay. So where I'm getting at is that the decision to go out that night was a poor one and it was unnecessary. And the risk involved versus the likelihood of having a successful outcome, should there even been a real rescue situation to provide, would have been nil. How do you pick someone out of the water in those conditions?
Yeah, and still make it back safely, right?
Right.
I mean,
on a 24-foot boat.
Yeah.
No. You just don't. There's a higher risk that the crew that's on board is going to end up over the side trying to pick up the one person that probably has drowned in those conditions anyways,
right,
than there is to successfully pick him up and bring him back and having everybody safe.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Now, let alone making the decision to go there just for training, when there isn't an emergency taking place, it's absolutely unnecessary because people were so scared on board that they weren't learning anything anyways.
Okay? Yeah, right. Sure.
It was no longer training. It was survival.
Mm-hmm.
It was pitch black. The radar is useless because, as you know, the antenna of your radar on an FRC might be 8 to 10 feet above the waterline.
Yeah.
And radio waves, which are highly reflective to water, all you're looking at is yellow mustard on the radar display.
Screen just washes out.
They don't work when the waves are double head over high, right?
Right. Yeah.
The radar is useless. And you're just jogging. I was just jogging against those waves. And I would make it, I would just crest the wave and the boat would fall what felt like 6 to 8 feet and just shudder. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We had an aluminum welded mast on top of the cage that houses the radome for the radar.
Right.
We broke that.
Ooh, yeah.
It gets snapped off. The welding, We couldn't turn around because of how close the waves were. We had gotten ourselves too deep and we had to punch through. So now there's the shoal where the water gets very, very shallow and the waves are like 12 to 15 feet stand up waves. Then it gets deep again, which makes the wave subside. And then there's another shoal at the opposite, at the exit end, if you're heading easterly, where it jacks up again, and then it gets deep again, and then you kind of get a break, right? We were able to punch through both sections and make it on the other side, and we had to go hide in a marina and call the team of instructors to come and pick us up in the truck because we weren't going to make it back through there.
Yeah.
Were you at the Lighthouse Pub?
So we went to the Lighthouse Pub.
Out of control.
No, we it was, people were pretty quiet on the ride back.
I believe it. Yeah.
And not impressed, to say the least. I don't think anybody should put themselves in that situation for any kind of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're human beings. We're not superhumans. There's our vessels, our training, and our bodies have limited capacity. And there has to be a proper risk analysis before you head out and really measure in a way that you can quantify whether you should go or not. So, for instance, there are various agencies that provide search and rescue, and they all have a risk analysis matrix in place. And what that allows them to do is to measure the risk. We studied those risk analysis matrices from different agencies that provide a similar service, and we came up with our own that we call the GAR score, and it stands for green, amber, and red scale, okay? And it's a point system where against certain parameters of risk, you score between 0 and 10, 10 being the riskiest. And it is the job of the coxswain to make sure that the newest, least comfortable crew member on board, their score is the score that goes on. So there can't be bullying, or it can't be biased, or it can't. What we're trying to do is favor the leadership so that it is supportive of your lowest denominator, like the crew member that's the newest, that is the least experienced, or maybe it's not the least experienced crew member. Maybe it's an advanced crew member that just simply does not feel comfortable with the risk at stake. Right. You know, what's at stake with the risk that would have to be taken to proceed with the activity. That is the risk score that goes on in the logbook. It tallies up and you end up with a score, a total score. And if you're under 23, you're in the green. And if you're between 24 and like
44, 37, I think.
Is it 44? I don't remember.
I think we used 44. We did use 44.
Yeah. And then from those scoring, if you're green, well, everybody agrees it's like a thumbs up situation. Let's go. And the GAR score gets reanalyzed as you go along because the situation will change. I mean, it might be flat calm right now, and it might be pretty easy going and not very challenging when you take on the tasking or when you embark on the activity. But an hour later, that might have changed drastically, and you need to revisit your GAR score as to whether you should remain out there or come back or abort or what have you. So it's a continuous assessment. It's not a set it and forget it. It's not written in stone. And anybody at any point of time on board the cabin can raise their hand and say, I would like to revise the GAR score. I'm no longer comfortable in terms of sea conditions, or maybe I'm getting seasick, or I don't feel well, what have you. Okay, so crew fitness, environmental conditions, experience of the crew, capability of the vessel, those are all factors that come into play into the total score. If you're in the red, you don't go. If you're in the orange, you kind of revise, okay, what could we do to go back to the green? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have a discussion and you try to come up with ways that would mitigate the risk against the factor that pushed the score from green to amber.
Right.
We call it the green, amber, red, which is similar to thumbs up, sideways, or down.
Yep.
Okay. That wasn't in place back in those days. Like the event I shared with you guys during the training, you know, it wasn't pretty. It's not something I'm proud of. I was assistant instructor at that time. I had all the information in front of me before we left in terms of weather. I did warn the other members of the instructor team that I felt it was going to be too hairy, but a communal decision was made to proceed anyways.
Yeah.
And I think that there might have been a little bit of that attitude in there. We go no matter what.
Right.
Right.
To infinity and beyond. These guys have to get used to that.
Yep.
That hero mentality, that we're indestructible. You know, it's almost as saying, well, it's going to look better in the newspaper if we all die in the process, because at least we tried, than if we said no and saved our lives. Okay? So politics and the public's perception, it's a big decision to make, and all that responsibility weighs a lot on the coxswain, the leadership team, of search and rescue units as to whether you should go or not.
And do you guys, Francois, do you use the STAR model? Like if you, let's say it's in the amber or the red and you can't go, because the Coast Guard recently transitioned to a new model, but I mean that one's been in use for a long time. Did you guys do the STAR model to kind of find, let's say you don't want to go because the seas are high and the boat's not built for it and the crew's inexperienced? You ever heard of STAR?
I have not heard of the STAR. You'll have to enlighten me on that one.
They call it spread out, transfer, avoid, reduce, and what's the last one, Minnick?
It was two A's, wasn't it? It was spread out, transfer, avoid,
accept,
reduce.
Yeah, reduce. So it's basically like just different alternatives, different courses of action that you could take so that you're not just doing nothing, right? Let's say that you can't accept the mission because it is too dangerous to the crew. You're only going to make the situation worse. Well, another option might be to spread it out, right? Let's call one of those offshore cutters to go out, you know, that are built for these kind of seas to go get eyes on and see if they can help versus us, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's exactly, I just didn't recall using that acronym.
Yeah.
But yeah, we do use a very, very similar procedure in order to mitigate the risk and disperse. And there's an analysis as to, well, you know, maybe we delegate to a different agency that's better suited for that situation.
Right. Sure. Yeah. So by not accepting the mission, you're not saying that I'm not going to do anything. You're saying, hey, we're going to find a different solution. I think that's what a lot of people have a hard time grasping, is that just because you're not going to go out doesn't mean that you're not going to still help get to the right outcome.
Just because you didn't get to be the hero on the poster doesn't mean you didn't help save somebody.
Right.
Absolutely. It's a team effort. There's no one individual that's responsible for the successful outcome of a rescue. Okay. There's a whole array of things that take place, such as communications with what we have here in Canada is the Joint Rescue Coordination Center. Mm-hmm. And their job is to coordinate and to initiate the task, coordinate the assets that are going to take place. They're going to be partaking in resolving the scenario or the tasking and concluding the mission. They're the overall authority over the tasking. The communications, the information that they provide, the chain of communication via vessel traffic, Coast Guard radio, and the assets that are on scene, it's all a big team effort.
Yep. Great way to put it, man. What a good discussion. Yeah.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
The way I kind of like to bring it home, Francois, is really the story and the lessons that you've learned throughout your career. What is the most important thing that you're teaching these volunteer coxswains with RCM SAR? What are like the key things that you want these guys to leave your training session with?
Essentially safety and decision-making and slowing everything down when you're in an emergency situation. People tend to have that false sense of urgency and they like to jump in the line of fire before they think. I think anybody that you pick off the street can do this job of being on a boat and hooking on a tow or picking someone out of the water. Eventually, it's just a technicality, like it's just technical training. Anybody with a proper training can do this. I think that where it differs is the thinking behind what you're going to be doing. For instance, we were talking about the risk analysis, you and I, the previous session, and how we quantify risk with a matrix. And for instance, we use the GAR score in our instance, which is GAR standing green, amber, red. And it gets measured against a pointage. And you have to be within a certain pointage to be able to say, okay, with reasonable, we got reasonable, we can go ahead. You know, like it's right. You know, the risk doesn't outweigh the benefit. Mm-hmm. Essentially. Now, where that gets tricky is someone like you and I, Phil, whom have hands-on experience and a lot of it on the water and in being stuck in an emergency response situation, you and I's idea of what is, let's say, a 17 out of 23 may be very different than someone that's inexperienced or doesn't have the same amount of exposure and may be influenced by their will to want to save the situation. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Sure.
And so what might be considered right at the cusp of being from a green light to an amber light to you and I, what leads to that decision for someone like you and me is very different than someone else.
Right. For sure.
So there's a lot of room for interpretation here when we're talking about risk analysis. Mm-hmm. So what I do when I train the coxswains is really trying to drill that in. Even at the final exam, when we do a mock-up of a real SAR situation, typically what I do is I have a boat drifting close to the beach, mimicking that they're completely broken down, maybe with like a medical on board. I purposely ask the other team to not wear a PFD or pretend that they're drunk or something like that. Try to make it as realistic as possible.
And then, it sounds very familiar, dude. Yeah, what do you think? Right. We use the same kind of thing for us. Exam. Yep. Same thing for us.
It is typically what we have to deal with in the summertime with pleasure boaters.
Sure.
People have not done their maintenance. The boat breaks down or they're out of fuel. They misjudge the weather forecast. They end up in a precarious situation. They've had a few too many to drink. Someone got injured. Maybe someone has heat stroke. Maybe someone has a medical on board from a pre-existing condition. And then you show up and you have to analyze this from a distance before you approach as to what's going on. You don't always have a whole lot of time to make a proper stop, assess, plan, and reanalyzing the risk before going in. You have to convene with your crew and delegate and being able to be open-minded for crew input as a coxswain. That's what I evaluate the most rather than their ability to hook on the line and tie a proper knot or a bowline to yank them out of there.
Right.
For sure. Because everybody can eventually learn to do that. Thinking outside the box, meaning that the way it's being taught in a book or in literature, you need to be able to apply the fundamentals of that to the real life situation. Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to think on your feet and apply the concept to the specifics of the situation, which is never the same. So I'll put him under stress. I'll purposely make sure that the situation is stressful and analyze how they think and how their brain react when they're under stress, because they don't have that opportunity very often. As we discussed prior to this, not being a professional person that's being paid to do this on a day-to-day basis, as a volunteer, you just simply don't benefit from the same exposure to these kind of situations. And you learn every time. So the more exposure you have, the better you get, and the more you can think on your feet, and the more I almost want to say jaded you are to the stress.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna ask you. That so after they graduate the course and they move on to their own station, right? One of the 35 stations that you guys have. Do you encourage them to kind of increase their exposure as time passes? You know, say the small craft advisory is hitting that day. Well, hey, now would be the time to kind of go out there and train and take some waves on the lower end of that maybe, and then do it before the alarm sounds. Do you guys encourage them to do that kind of thing? Just increase it as they feel comfortable?
100%.
Yeah.
And there's a huge responsibility on the individual themselves to take care of their own learning curve.
Yep.
It's all adult learning. There's only so much I can do. I can't hold their hands forever. They have to take responsibility and take what they've learned from the experience I shared with them, the experience they gathered through being a member and through the calls that they've been exposed, and just maintain that skill set. It's a perishable skill. You don't use it, you lose it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yep. Love it.
Yeah.
There are sign-offs that they have to continue. There's continued training at station level, and there's a minimum amount of hours that they have to complete, whether it's training or minimum amount of taskings that they have to be on as coxswains in order to maintain their coxswain status.
I love it, man. There's really not as big a difference between the RCM SAR and the United States Coast Guard and pretty much every other boat rescue unit I've seen in the U.S.
Everything you're telling me, I'm like, oh, yeah, we do that. Yep. Yep. Okay.
Yep, I
hear where you're coming from. Yeah.
For sure.
Well, as you guys know and are well aware, there's the AMSAR manual, the International mm-hmm. Aeronautical and Marine Search and Rescue. The Canadian format
maritime search and rescue system is based off of that.
Right.
We're a signatory country to the International Maritime Organization, and we do a lot of co-training internationally with other volunteer organizations around the world, like the KNRM in the Netherlands, the RNLI in England, which is the oldest lifeboat society, you know, and so on. We do a coxswain exchange program, and we have a program to essentially promote the coxswains that do a lot at their station, whether they're station leaders or coxswains that have done a lot, they have a lot of hours, a lot of dedication. We'll promote them by sending them to a coxswain exchange that takes place in Europe, and then they gather intel from how things are done and protocols in Europe from organizations that have been around for hundreds of years.
Right, for sure.
Man, I want to do a coxswain exchange.
Yeah, I want to do a coxswain exchange,
right,
too.
Phil?
Yeah. Me and Francois were talking about it before. I was like, man, it'd be pretty cool if we could, you know, if we made something happen and we get to go drive each other's boats.
Absolutely.
I can't tell you how valuable that would be, Phil. I'd be so pleased to be able to bring that to our team. So, I mean, it wouldn't be up to me. It'd be up to the people above me and the management to make that kind of decision.
For sure.
Yeah. But it's definitely something I would encourage.
I 100% agree, man. Yeah. I think
unfortunately, it's not up to us either.
Yeah, it's you know, everything takes time, but I do. Right. We definitely want to. The topic's been broached. How about we'll leave it at that, man? Yeah, we'll leave it at that for the podcast. But the topic's been raised.
Yep.
We've had a lot of the European countries open up their doors to us. The KNRM have come over and taught courses for us for jet boat operations. I don't know if you're aware, but most Northern Europe volunteer search and rescue organizations utilize boats are launched from the beach at you know, with a truck, and they're all jet drives.
Or a really sweet rail, man. Don't forget those awesome looking rails, right? That's got to be a ride, you know?
Some of the stuff I've seen on YouTube is pretty crazy. Like some of their launches in the North Sea is just absolutely nuts. Like they're going in like stern first and trying to launch this thing. And
what's what I'm just thinking about, like your tidal difference, man, you know, like imagine if you had to launch at a low tide and just what would happen.
Well, not only that, but just the way that our beaches are designed, most of our coast is just rocking straight down to the bottom of the seabed. There's not that beautifully like slow sandy beach. It's more like California, you know.
Hang on, let's go. I love it.
You don't dump the boat off the cliff and go, right?
You can dump it off the cliff once.
once.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I have a good relationship with the Redningsselskapet, which is the Norwegians.
Mm-hmm.
Their structure is extremely similar to ours. They have roughly 30 to 40 stations up and down the Norwegian coast. All volunteers, just a very small amount of stations that have coxswains and engineers that are on paid salary. Their fleet is quite impressive for being manned by civilians and volunteers. They have a simulator program and a training center very similar to ours. They have a full-blown pool like the RNLI where they do rewriting training for the rewriting systems on ribs. Very very impressive, good bunch of guys, very open to exchange, and they've been around for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, the Norwegians, man, they're the Vikings.
Right.
That's a maritime going nation, that's it.
You know, that's what everybody thought when you said Norwegians. Everybody was like, oh, the Vikings.
Yeah. I just imagined like Viking longboats going out to save people.
That would be cool, man. If you got to get saved, get saved by
Norwegians,
Viking.
What you actually pictured was yourself at the lighthouse in Norway drinking out of empty
skulls. Well, that's after we save people in the longship. Then we go back and drink out of the skulls of our enemies.
And there you go.
That's right.
You know, it's cool that you're talking about the pools, Francois, because the, you know, everybody's, you guys have a cabin on your boats. So do you guys practice egress from the cabin?
Okay, so good question, Phil. Just to reiterate, we have two vessels. We have a primary and a secondary. The primary vessel is typically a Type 1, which is the Titan cabin boat with the Hamilton jet system.
Right.
It's just shy of 40 feet, just shy of 5 gross tons. It weighs about, the boat I think weighs 10 tons. It's about 20,000 pounds. Okay. It can stop within its own length by reversing the thrust on the bucket.
Oh, yeah.
We call that an emergency stop
We call procedure. Them crash stops.
It's a crash stop.
Yep.
Absolutely. It just walks right on the nose and just stops right now.
The rooster tail, right? Right in the back. Yep.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. It's got its applications. Those vessels are not rewritable. They're self-writable.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a Stolast approved vessel. They're full-on lifeboat, meaning that they can rewrite themselves on their own, and there's like a harness system inside where the crews are actually harnessed in once the sea conditions warrant. Like, we have SOPs for that when they have to be strapped in.
Right.
Okay.
Stolast vessels have very stringent regulations to make them a Stolast boat, like Stolast meaning safety of life at sea conventions.
Right.
So that's our primary vessel. Our secondary vessel is a Type 2, and that's an open rib with an inflatable bladder on top that is a rewriting system.
Oh, that's cool, man, because, yeah, so that's something the Coast Guard's only just recently picked up was the those inflatable rewriting systems, because we've had U.S. Coast Guard's had, you know, several capsizes of boats that weren't designed to rewrite, and probably took that idea from the Canadians, I would think.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it's very possible.
Can I make a point on what we were talking about earlier on now that I have an idea about this capsizing business?
Yeah, for sure.
Sure.
If you think that there's a danger that you're going to capsize a giant floating jacket with twin 200 horse on strapped to the ass end of it, maybe you shouldn't be out there.
that's fair, man. Fair. That's fair. Yeah.
Okay, you got a giant tube that's filled with air in a low freeboard vessel with a deep V. If you're going to capsize that thing, there's one or two things happening. You're in conditions that are way too much and you're way over your head, or you don't know what you're doing and you're not properly trained.
I think that second one's the one that seems to hit pretty frequently.
Right.
So we do train for worst case scenario, but let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to flip up that boat, the likelihood that you're in a good enough shape to be able to trigger the rewriting mechanism and swim to safety, wait for the boat to rewrite itself, gather your crew and swim underneath the hull, very little.
Yeah, man, and also, the other thing with that too is, we call it, you guys probably have the same thing, warranted risk. You know, when is it appropriate to take risks? So in the U.S. Coast Guard, they say that the possibility of saving a life warrants maximum effort, right? Which means that you could get into some weird situations sometimes. But the question would be, if something goes wrong, are you going to make the situation
worse?
You know, way worse, right? Or are you just going to compound it? So that's always
the assessment that you do prior to proceeding.
For sure.
Yep. And that is an ongoing thing. I mean, you may depart the station with the very good understanding the conditions on sea are quite treacherous.
Right.
And as you approach the location of the distress vessel, you got to stop at least 100 to 150 feet away, conduct a proper stop, assess, plan, and then reassess the risk and reconvene with your crew as to their level of comfort to proceed and come up with a plan. How are we going to do this? What kind of equipment do we need? What's going to be the approach? And where are we going after?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So all that takes into consideration whether you actually proceed or not.
Sure. And I mean, I was going to say, Francois, you've been doing this a long time. You know, no matter what, no matter how long you've been doing it and what you think you're going to find when you get there, it's never what you think you're going to find. It's always something different.
The information that you have from the Joint Rescue Coordination Center or the Coast Guard radio or the people on scene that have called the Mayday or the distress, it's information that lost in translation. You know, it started off and you got a guy with a ripped off leg, and you show up and it turns out that they have a sprained ankle. You know,
right, that's true.
Right.
It's never the same.
That's the good one. It's when you hear it's a sprained ankle.
Yeah. You know, sometimes the LKP is being reported as being northeast of such and such island. And you get up there and it's southeast of an adjacent island, or it's not right there at all.
Yeah, my favorite one is like they're by light whatever, but it's actually buoy whatever, right? Like they're by light number two, but nope, it was buoy number two. There's a big difference there.
Yeah.
And as you know yourself, and as you get to know your area of operation, Phil, and I'm sure it's something that you guys have done, you receive some information, and from experience, you're able to actually decode it.
Right.
And disregard parts of the information and actually proceed to where you think it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
We also have another challenge in our area where indigenous people have their own local names to certain areas,
right,
which are different than the charted names.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get information as to the location of a distressed vessel as it pertains to a local area, and the name of that local area is not anywhere on the chart.
Right.
Because it's a localized, locals only know what that name is and what it means.
Right.
So you have to have an intimate relationship with that to understand what that is.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
And I, so you know, it's funny, man. Like,
the community around your area of operation is also very important.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that that all of us are probably aware of, you know, training people, right? As you're training volunteers, Bill and I have spent a lot of time training new accessions.
Like, they're just paid volunteers.
Paid volunteers, right? But you know, when you have a crew that's worked together for a few years and are firing on all cylinders and have seen a plethora of things, have all that local knowledge that you're talking about, have exposed themselves increasingly to more risk as they, you know, try to build skills and everything. The way that it's ran is totally different, right? But because you can feed off each other. You can kind of, you know what the next guy's thinking, and some things don't even have to be said. It could be done with a nod or whatever. But what's interesting, I think, about training new people and volunteers that don't have that kind of relationship with their crews is just how much people tend to lack knowledge, right? I mean, and just skills in general. I mean, you really have to start kind of at basics with some things, because everybody's got strengths and weaknesses. And it's funny, like you might have the top tier guy at that station that comes out to training, but there's probably something that they need to work on,
right?
And get better
Absolutely.
At.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how much we take for granted that
right.
is the language.
Every day is a cool day, man.
Else, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, language and stuff's second nature to us, and we forget people just don't know it.
I think that as a trainer, it's got to be one of the biggest challenges is to keep your cool and be patient with people.
Right. 100%, man.
Exactly. Yeah. A fantastic point that you just said there is that you tend to forget that it's not a natural thing that comes to most.
Right.
It comes with experience and exposure, and it's what we do. We're submersed in it for years, and then you got a brand new civilian with next to zero boating knowledge, and all of a sudden you find yourself yelling at them for something that you assume they should know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the case. But then again, if you're not being yelled at when you're on a boat, there's something wrong.
It just doesn't feel nautical anymore. Yeah, I love it, man. That's good.
You're not on a boat anymore if you're not being yelled
That's
at.
That's right. Somebody's the captain, man. There's a
I'm
captain.
I'm glad that crosses international boundaries.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Now, if you step on a boat, it's got to be implied that you're going to be getting yelled at.
Yep.
That's just my policy.
I love it, man.
That's the quote from this episode.
Yep. Well, Francois, dude,
the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Francois, man, we so much appreciate you coming on and talking about RCM SAR, your time with the Canadian Coast Guard, and you know, those important lessons that you're passing on to the next generation as they go out there and try to make a difference at sea. I'll ask you any parting shots, man. Anything you'd like to throw out there before we end it?
Well, I think that the big topic of the conversation was training and what it's like to be a trainer, what's important to me as a trainer, and so on. And just to add to your comment here that you said about, you know, going out on a call and not knowing what the level of skill is among the crew and so on. For me, the biggest payoff as a trainer with civilians is to watch them at the final evaluation with zero coaching, handle the situation like a boss, like just like flawless.
Yep.
And the communications and everything is flowing smoothly. And the situation gets resolved very safely, effectively, and it's snappy. Everybody knows and is able to anticipate what needs to happen next. Good decisions are being made, good seamanship, good boat handling, and you're standing back as an instructor and you're like, wow.
You're just beaming with pride, dude. That's what it's you're like doing. Beaming with pride.
You know, because 5 days prior, some of these guys were still mixing port and starboard.
Right. Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like I'm exaggerating, but it's such a nice thing to see that learning curve
for sure, man. And you know, I think it's cool too.
Validating thing.
Yep, absolutely. And I think you know, kind of a for trainers too. I learn something every time I train. I mean, I might train 400 guys a year in the exact same skill set. And I bet you out of like those 400, 398 of them either showed me something that I didn't think was possible because they did something crazy.
You find a different way.
Yeah, man. Yeah. There's all like you're always learning. So even guys that are real experienced at it and even guys that train it professionally are always learning from each other. So I think that's that's a huge lesson for anyone to take away is that, you know, always be learning. You got to be teachable.
It's a very dynamic experience. It's a never-ending thing, and that's what keeps me in that field of work. It's it never stops to – it never ceases to amaze me. It's you know, you nailed it. It's the best way to get good at something and have a multitude of perspective on how to do one thing is to teach it over and over and over again. You always find better ways or a different perspective. And if you get a blockage, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, just baffle them with bullshit, it always works.
Yeah, man. Hey, and we're just talking about people right now. At the end of the day, the ocean will kick your ass anyway, right? Like no matter exactly. What you think you got right, it'll show you.
The ocean doesn't care that you're there.
Never turn your back to the ocean. Never stop having a healthy dose of fear.
Yep.
Fear exists in your brain for a reason. It's a defense mechanism. And anybody that will come to me and tell me they're not scared of anything is how I identify stupidity.
I like it, man. That's well true. Said. Very well said.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, be humble. The ocean will show you, you know. Don't ever think that you're stronger or more powerful or just face it face to face. And if you forgot about your weaknesses and your limitations, the ocean is really good at putting a mirror in your face and showing you your reflection and what you're really made up of.
Yeah, man. When you get back and you're kissing the ground because you finally made it back to shore, right?
Right.
Absolutely. Yep. Oh, I'm always thankful to the ocean for letting me in and letting me out.
Yeah, let me out. Yeah, that's
sometimes
the key.
It feels like I knocked on the devil's door and ran away just before he opened the door, you know?
For sure, man.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Francois, dude, again, we very much appreciate your time, man. I know we had a couple technical difficulties. Thanks for coming back on to help us finish it out strong. And, again, thanks for what you're doing up there, man, to make a difference and to train others to do the same.
Well, I can't thank you guys enough for reaching out to me. I think that you found me through my Facebook page, the Coxswain Leadership Training on Facebook. There's a lot of videos on there about the training that we do. It's open to the public. Don't be afraid to like our page. Again, it's called RCMSAR Coxswain Leadership. It should pop up. And there's videos about final exams that we do. And there's some informative material I'll post on there. When you do post this particular interview here, this podcast, and you send me the link, I'll post it onto that page as well for our to see if they're interested. But yeah, other than that, I can't thank you enough. And it's so nice to meet guys from the Star Brotherhood. It doesn't have any boundaries as far as I'm concerned. And hopefully in the near future, we can actually meet one-on-one and exchange some great ideas and experience. I would be happy to host you guys as guest trainers, or even come and visit the training center. I would be happy to host you guys and show you guys a good time.
Can we hit the lighthouse while we're there?
That's the question.
We'll hit the lighthouse, guaranteed.
Perfect, right. Man. Francois, right. Thanks, dude. We really appreciate it, man. Yep.
Hey, thanks, Francois. Appreciate your time and your patience with all the technical difficulties.
No worries, and stay safe out there.
Same to you, brother. You too, man. Safe. Thanks again.
Cheers.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooutcom or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.